and the world for being rather good.
Right. Well, listen, please don't delay any longer, because we're so thrilled to have your guest with us and to be able to spend the hour with him. It's really wonderful.
Well, yes, me too. And as an actor, David McCallum has enjoyed a career spanning some 7 decades. In the 1960s, in the classic spy series, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., he played the suave Russian spy Ilya Kuryakin. And the series was hugely popular. And as David McCallum tells the story frequently these days, he himself was very popular with his fans. He was treated like a pop star. And in fact, he was dubbed the blonde beetle for his floppy hair and his boyish charm. Well, we now know him as Ducky, the chief medical examiner on NCIS, another show known by an acronym, and it is the most successful, most watched TV drama currently on the air anywhere in the world. David is also an author, having recently written his first novel titled Once a Crooked Man. But Rod, it all started with a big break, and perhaps more appropriately, a big breakout in the movies. In fact, it was 1963, a film with an instantly recognisable soundtrack and a stellar cast. Steve McQueen, James Garner, Richard Attenborough, Charles Bronson, Gordon Jackson, and at the age of 30, David McCallum. In fact, David plays the character that comes up with the ingenious way to get rid of the soil or the dirt that was being dug out of a tunnel that made the great escape possible.
You fill these bags with the dirt from the tunnel. Then, wearing them inside your trousers, you wander out into the compound where you pull these strings in your pockets. Out come the pins.
Eric, it's good.
All you have to do is kick it in. Unless you're a complete fool, the ferrets will never see a thing.
It's indecently brilliant. What do you think, Roger?
We'll try it first thing tomorrow.
I already have. It works.
We entered through the agent's entrance, and we are now in UNCLE headquarters. That's the United Network Command for Law and Enforcement. U.N.C.L.E. is an organization consisting of agents of all nationalities. It's involved in maintaining political and legal order anywhere in the world.
My name is Napoleon Solo. I'm an enforcement agent in Section 2 here. That's operations and enforcement.
I am Ilya Kuryakin. I am also an enforcement agent. Like my friend Napoleon, I go and I do whatever I am told to by our chief.
Bringing the story up to date, the theme from NCIS, which has just recently celebrated its 300th edition, a feat which is rarely achieved in television these days, and the series with its 2 spin-offs is still going strong. David, hello, great to see you. I love the smile on your face as you were listening to all of that.
Well, you know, it's like, I don't know, it's like being in the Smithsonian or in the British Museum, seeing all these wonderful things. And all, I may say, still with boyish charm, I hope.
Oh, very definitely. Let me introduce you to Rod.
Hello, Rod. David.
Good evening, pleasure. Good morning, or wherever
morning,
we are,
yes,
in this great
lovely
world.
Good evening from Los Angeles, yeah. And you have written this book, and I want to quickly talk about this to start with, and we can talk about all the great shows that you've been in as well. But and I want to talk about it right at the top, because I've been reading it for the last few days. It's your first novel, is that correct?
Yes, yes.
What inspired you to do this?
Well, I mean, nothing really inspired me. I've always been autodidactic. I left school when I was 15/16 with, you know, matriculation, the stamp of approval of the British government, and everything really of any substance since then I've pretty well taught myself. And there was a time when I was reading a novel by Jack Higgins on tape, or on whatever we did it back then, and I thought, looking at the pages, I could do this. And it was a very conceited thought, but I went home and I took paper and pencil and I tried to write down a story. I must have been out of work at the time, because I began with the idea of an actor being handed a suitcase that contained $1 million and thought, what would he do? What would happen? And then over the years, whenever I was out of work or needing something to, you know, while away the time, I would take these pages out and I'd continue them. I put them on a small computer and I would work on my laptop. I could take it places. I could do it on airplanes. And about 4 or 5 years ago, 4 years ago, I found it and I thought, this is ridiculous. You should finish it. And so I took it out and I finished it and gave it to somebody. And lo and behold, we're now a month into printing here in the United States, and we've already had three, what do they call them?
Reprints?
Reprints, yes. Yes.
It is being very successful. Once a Crooked Man is the title. And clearly you draw from some of your experience on NCIS and your studying of forensics, because the plot lines, and I don't want to spoil anything for people who haven't read the book and would like to, but the plot lines are intricate.
Yes, well, I think that's a product of doing it over 15 years. You know, things wouldn't quite work, so I'd go off at a tangent, and then you have to pull all the tangents together. And it seems to have worked. And the extraordinary thing is people have compared me to wonderful people that I read, and that's fascinating. But at the same time, I seem to have developed a style of writing over the years. And now that they're asking me to do another book, of course, I'm wondering if I have to do it in 15 months instead of 15 years, can I still discover that style?
What's your writing process? Do you sit down early in the morning, as a lot of people do, and say, OK, I've got to knock out half a chapter before 8 a.m., or is it more sporadic than that?
It's very simple. I force myself to not to prevaricate and to get my butt on the seat in front of the keyboard. Once I've overcome all of the distractions and I've done that, I then focus very much on the individual that I'm writing about in that particular section and where he's come from and where he's going to go, and try to just paint a picture. It's a process almost of watching a movie of the book, the section of the book, in my own mind, and then putting that down on paper and trying to be as true as possible to the actual character themselves. And then I learned from an editor that I worked with along the way certain basics that you follow, and I follow those now, which means I don't have to rewrite 5 or 6 times. Mostly what I write now is, well, let's call it passable. It's going to be edited. It's going to be rewritten. But I'm so much further along in the process when I sit down and write.
And there is one of the characters is an actor. And I'm curious, would you like to play that actor?
No, I couldn't possibly play. Harry Patrick Murphy is the son of an Irish immigrant policeman in Brooklyn. And that demands a whole persona, which couldn't be further away from a wee kid from Glasgow, you know?
David, it's Rod here, and I'm so pleased to be able to talk to you. By the way, I just want to throw the net open a little bit to our listeners who can text us on 85058 or send a tweet to Peter at Peter Bowes or to me, which is at Rod_Sharp. And, you know, we'll try to feed these into the conversation as we go along. I wondered, do you set yourself a limit at all when you're writing, or do you just write as much as you feel you need to that day for the plot? I mean, if it's gone over 15 years, it doesn't sound as if you haven't cracked the whip exactly.
No, and I never intended to publish a book. This was an exercise in learning myself to put the words on the page. What I did today, oddly enough, was I got myself one of those desks that sits on a desk. And when you stand up, you just touch it and it comes up, so you can write standing up as well as sitting down. Because I discovered at the tender age of, well, I'm going to be 83 this year, the legs need all the assistance they can get. So in an odd way, my writing is entirely dependent upon the strength of my legs.
Amazing. And do you find that you can write standing up? Do you type or do you write longhand?
I can do it in any position possible. It's uh-huh. It's now that you have laptops and various programs, even on my iPhone, I have a program and all I do is press a microphone and I can talk into it. Yeah. So if I'm on a
Does it
bus,
understand you? It doesn't always understand me.
Well, it understands me perfectly, but it doesn't matter if there's a few mistakes because the ideas, you've suddenly had an idea that so-and-so is going to do this and this and what a great idea. So you talk it into your iPhone. You can then email it to yourself as a Word document and then print it out when you get home so you don't forget what you've written. And very often you can then transfer a great deal of that right into whatever you're doing because it's, you know, it's pure. It's an idea that comes out very cleanly.
And may I ask you, who do you read or who have you read that you're conscious of maybe over the period of this book?
Oh. that's rather difficult. I mean, I go back and read Richard Feynman again. There's a book I keep going back to called The Dancing Woolly Masters, which those know about it will know about it. I read a great deal about pathology and basic pathology, cellular activity, in order to keep up with the job, in a way. I like science books. I obviously love Clive Cussler, Michael Connelly, John Grisham when those books come out. I've always thoroughly enjoyed those. And there's another book. Actually, I'm reading books on politics at the moment, trying to keep up, not very successfully.
When it sounds as if you've amassed quite a knowledge over the years. Do you actually have conversations with pathologists these days about their science and about what they do?
Oh, yeah, they come and visit the set. And not long ago, we had a gentleman from, I think it was San Jose County, but he'd been born in Bangladesh or somewhere on the Indian continent. And there was a patient, I couldn't call him a patient, there was a body on the table. And it was an actor, and he was sound asleep. And quite naked, except for the covering his genitals. And these two pathologists, we were discussing, I think, aortic stenosis or something, when the actor woke up and sat up, and the pathologist leapt back and in good goon style said, "Oh, my God, that has never happened to me." Which actually was a wonderfully wonderful moment. And what's so wonderful, when you go downtown and all of this death and destruction, you're surrounded by it, but there is a sense of humor that is quite extraordinary. The first day I went down there were five of the most, shall we say, graphic autopsies taking place.
This is the coroner's office in Los Angeles.
Yes, coroner's downtown. And right over the top on the wall is a big sign that says no eating or drinking. Which is sort of, I don't know if somebody put that up in all seriousness.
Yeah. I wonder how do you think it would translate to radio? Because one of our network's plans for the year is to do a live broadcast from post-mortem, which struck me as rather enterprising.
Yeah, so it's probably better than doing it on film because all they do on film is fog things out and avoid all the furry bits. And that just becomes a distraction. So I would imagine if you did it on radio or in any medium that didn't have a picture, you could be much more graphic. And, you know, it's well known that if you describe something in you know, without seeing it, it can be much more dramatic. I mean, go back to the Hitchcock films. Nowadays, with television the way it is the graphic imaging that they do, there's nothing left to the imagination at all.
And when you go to the coroner's office, and you've been doing this for quite a while now, how closely involved do they allow you to be?
Well, for a long time, I watched through the glass. There's a corridor and a long window, and they're all performing the autopsies on the other side. And there's one room, which is a private room, and then a clean room where doctors come to take organs which are going to be used for transplants. So I actually talked the coroner into letting me go into the private room when one of the pathologists was doing an autopsy. And I stood right beside him throughout the entire, it was about 2.5 hours. And it took that long simply because he was teaching me the whole time. And but we had you know, earphones with the wind blowing through your mask. So it was very difficult to hear him. But the images that I took away from that have made a tremendous difference. And now when I walk into autopsy, I ask which table, where is it? At what point are we in the autopsy? And I can now set it up the way it really is.
And I think it's a world clearly that most of us, especially those of us not aspiring to go into a medical career or a forensic career, can't really imagine what it must be like to be in that autopsy room. Was there something about the experience? You were an actor, you were a musician before you began your interest in this. Was there something that particularly struck you that you didn't expect?
Well, the first thing I did, I didn't have breakfast that morning. as a precaution the first time I went. And then when you get there, you realize that every single one of these pathologists is trying to solve a problem. Why did this particular individual die? What caused his death? Be it for insurance or for some forensic reason. Most people die and are not autopsied. Just the case of the Chief Justice here, there was no autopsy. It was the doctor by his side who took care of everything. But the ones that are autopsied, there's always a reason. So you get very involved in the sort of Sherlock Holmes aspect of the whole thing. Then once you see the human body eviscerated, because that's really the only word you can use, it is quite magical. It's one hell of a design, and it's so compact, and it works so beautifully. I've become very interested in cellular activity and the fact that the human egg and sperm is so tiny you can't see it with a naked eye, and yet it carries volumes of information. How can something so small carry so much information and then pass it on? And then within the body itself, all of things begin to happen because of that extraordinary moment of conception. So I began to think, if they can do it there, maybe some of the other cells are smarter than we think they are. And if I cut my thumb, does my toe know that my thumb has been cut? Is there a form of communication on a cellular level? And to me, now that we're getting into this incredibly microcosmic world everywhere, that I find that quite fascinating.
David and Peter, I can't believe we've got to 2:30 already, but we have. So we're going to leave you for a couple of minutes and come straight back as fast as we can. And we're back in Los Angeles with Peter Bowes and our special guest, David McCallum. David, there's quite a lot of fascination out there for your roots. And I'll put it very simply in the words of Gary, who's the cabbie from Glasgow. David, where in Glasgow are you from?
I was born in Curzon Street, within sight of Botanic Gardens, Maryhill. 2518, I seem to remember, was the phone. No, that was when we moved. And my father was a musician. Soon after I was born, he became the leader of the Scottish Orchestra. And then Sir Thomas Beecham and Henry Wood both wanted him. And father ended up with Beecham as the leader of the London Philharmonic. After the war, when they reformed the Royal Philharmonic, father went in as leader and stayed with Beecham right up until the 70s. And in fact, I was my cousin Mary was playing with the Choral Society at Carnegie Hall the other day, and I went. And I was kind of very sort of pleased because my son Val, who plays with Jackson Browne and many, many other people, he played in Carnegie Hall. My father played the Delius Violin Concerto in Carnegie Hall, and here was Mary up there playing with the choral society. She's a cellist, by the way. She does an awful lot of Broadway shows. And then someone said, hey, but you've been up there too. And I said, what? And of course, the first upfront of NCIS was at Carnegie Hall. and the whole cast walked onto stage, stood at the back, and then walked forward as a line. Mm. And I'll never forget it. I mean, it was just so, so special.
And the upfront, so when essentially the show is being sold
for the first year, yes, all the shows are there. And it's very brief. You're up there, they applaud, off, next show, you know.
And thankfully it was picked up, as they say,
in the industry. It was picked up. Was it 9 shows? I don't know. It starts very, very quietly, these things all. I was very positive. I think with that much talent and with Don Belisario, who created the whole thing, with all of that, this has got to have legs. Little did I know.
But did 300 editions? I mean, which these days, as I mentioned earlier, is really quite a feat in modern day television.
Well,
to get that far,
yes. Having struggled to write a book over all these years, the fact that a group of writers they individually pick a show, are given a show, and then they write them in, and they collaborate. But the fact that a group of writers has come up with 300 wonderful scripts in the time, in 13 years, to me, is the most remarkable thing of the whole, part of the whole thing.
And you're the medical examiner.
Yes.
And you are, you tell me, what kind of actor are you? You receive the script, you learn your lines, but in that moment, do you like to be more than the actor? Do you enjoy the choreography of the scene, as it were?
Anthony Hopkins, is that nice Welsh actor?
I think I've heard of him.
He was interviewed. He said, well, I've been doing this for quite some time, and I get the script, I learn the lines, I go along, I do the best I can, and then I go home. And that's basically what it is when you've been doing it for 70 years. Obviously, there is a nervousness. In my case, I've always been very nervous to get it right. And after, we're doing the scene for a little while, I can learn to relax and everything. But basically, you do what the writer has written. And number basic 101 acting, you listen to the other actors. And how you perform is entirely based on what they're saying. So it becomes a conversation.
And making television like this, it's in a sense quite a clinical process, isn't it? You will record a scene that might last 90 seconds and yes. You do it again and you do it again so the cameras get you from different angles.
And the extraordinary statistic is it takes 8 days to shoot one NCIS show, which is 43 minutes long. So if I'm in 5 minutes of those, as you mentioned, short scenes, that means I'm spending 8 working days plus weekends to do 5 minutes work. So what acting in television is all about waiting. You're waiting whether you're called the next day. You're driving there. You're driving back. You're sitting waiting in your dressing room because they're finishing up the scenes of the morning and you're the next scene. That can take up 4 or 5, 6 hours. It's not untrue when people say watching people do television is like watching grass grow. It has a slow, but then those magical moments when you're actually on camera in a scene with Mark Harmon and Paulie comes flying in her 6-inch heels and there's something to say, Gibbs, 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 Gibbs. I mean, it's magic time.
David, there are lots of questions about the early parts of your career and about your friends from back then. And in particular, here's somebody who would like to know if you are indeed still friendly with Joanna Lumley from your Sapphire and Steel days. And they say, would she ever be cast as an old friend of Ducky in NCIS?
No, a young friend of Ducky, please.
A young friend, pardon me, yes.
I would cast Joanna Lumley in almost anything, I think. When we did Sapphire and Steel, she was a close friend the whole time. She's one of the smartest and most beautiful and talented people I have ever met. And the man who actually did the show, Sean O'Riordan, he produced the show. It is my regret that my friend Sean and people like Joanna live 3,000 miles away. Well, it's 6,000 miles away now. But from New York, where I live, it's just that big pond in between means that I can't call up and say, let's have dinner tonight. That is a regret.
That's Joanna Lumley's name, isn't it, at the bottom of the front cover of your book there?
Yes, I sent her a copy early on the galleys, and she wrote McCallum's first book, Dazzles. So bless her heart. And the next time I see her, I'll have to give her a big kiss on the cheek and take her out for a very expensive dinner.
How about Robert Vaughn?
Robert, we don't see much of each other. We've gone different ways in many ways. The last time I spoke to him was in November on the 22nd. I called and wished him a happy birthday. It's always ironic, the whole Kennedy family tragedy, and Robert's birthday happened to coincide. But it means it's one of the few birthdays that I managed to remember, including all my grandchildren. And actually, one grandchild was born on my father's birthday, so that one never gets forgotten.
Are all your grandchildren in the United States?
Yes, I have 6 towheads, all boys in New York, and 2 girls here in California, because my first marriage, my 2 sons both have daughters.
Here's a question, which I'm not entirely sure I understand, but let me try it on you anyway. Ask Mr. McCallum about recommending Jimmy Page, I guess, to use a violin bow on a guitar.
That happened a long time ago. My father was, I think he was doing a gig somewhere and playing with Rod Stewart or something. But Jimmy Page was there. Or it may have been my son Val, because I know they opened for Rod Stewart at one point. And he may have introduced my father. But Jimmy Page and my father got together, and father suggested using the bow on the guitar, and he's done it ever since. Amazing. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful folk story.
What was your instrument when you were growing up? Were you encouraged to take something up?
Yes, I tried the cello because my mother was a cellist. I tried the violin. If I was practicing and my father came home, he would say, "Oh, don't do that while I'm here, please." Fully understandable. So he looked around and saw that there was a shortage of oboe players. I mean, there was Evelyn Rothwell and a few others, but there was he had an 8-year-old son, so he thought, well, he'd better be an oboe player. So I worked with Leonard Brain, the principal oboe of the London Philharmonic, Dennis Brain's brother, the famous horn player. And for many years, I played the oboe. Like the manuscript of my book, it went in a drawer for quite a long time. But when I was in New York recently and my cousin Mary came over with a cello, we were playing duets in the living room, oboe and cello. And Catherine, my wife, was sitting on the sofa and said, "You know, I've known you for 50 years and that's the first time I've ever heard you play the oboe," which is wonderful and sad all in one.
So you spend most of your time, well, clearly you work here in Los Angeles and a lot of time here, but home is New York.
Yes, home is in New York, but then 10 months here with NCIS.
That must be tough.
Well, it's marriage by cell phone. I know what she looks like, but at the same time, whenever there's a problem, she was supposed to arrive tomorrow with 2 of the grandchildren, one from my son and one from my daughter. And one of them, sadly, has a terrible ear infection and is not allowed to travel. So we had to cancel everything. But all of the arrangements, all of the working with JetBlue, all of that has to be done can so wonderfully be done on a cell phone. And the minute anything happens, I get a text, "What's this?" And I text back, and then we talk. So it's an extraordinary relationship, but it's a very good one.
And you said earlier you're 83 years old. What
almost
83. What keeps you going? I mean, you describe this extremely busy life. It could be easier.
Well, I suppose I've developed the art of the nap down to maybe I should make that the subject of my next book, because I find that whenever I have even 5 minutes, I can consciously relax, and particularly when I'm working, I have one of those nice chairs that goes horizontal. And if I have 5 minutes, I can go sound asleep. I'm modeling myself on Winston Churchill that way. But I suppose my motto is I've got to do what needs to be done, and that's about it. And you can always find the energy to do that.
And is there a secret to longevity in your business?
Well, I give thanks to the pharmacological industry and to I have a cardiologist in New York and one here, and the medical profession and the breakthroughs that have taken place. Because my brother, my mother, my father, everybody, they all died at 75. And so when I got to 76, I opened a bottle of champagne, and I still have the cork. You know, you do, as I say, you do the best you can when it's necessary. And obviously, having to be at the studio at 6 or 7 in the morning, looking your best, with your brain working, puts a certain set of parameters on your lifestyle, which I think is wonderful when you're growing older, because it's so easy just not to do this or not to do that. But when you have to be there and you have to be on time and you have to be contributing in every possible way.
And I happen to know this is a studio that's, what, 30, 35 miles from where you live?
Yeah, it's a 70-mile each day commute, which it plays havoc with my knees, my quads.
That's why when you came in here, David came in and insisted on standing up for as long as he possibly could before we started the interview to stretch his legs.
It's de rigueur. Yes. And driving cars is the worst, although Volvo is great because the seats are designed by a surgeon. Can't remember the word, but it's wonderful.
Maybe an orthopedic surgeon.
Yes,
orthopedic surgery. It's terrible for your hamstrings, all this enforced seating. And I'm absolutely fascinated by your standing desk that rises and falls at a touch. I think
there may be some
changes at this end too. I used to do the whole show, 4 hours of it standing up, and for the last few years I've been sedentary, and I think my hamstrings have shortened actually as a result.
Well, we have a very, very good friend in Robert Mueller, who was the director of the FBI for more than 10 years, the normal time. And I went to his office at the FBI one day, and there isn't a desk in the room. The only thing is a standing-up desk, which looks like something out of a Dickensian film. And that's where he does all his work, standing up.
Absolutely. I would hugely recommend it. I don't know if you remember, Rod, some time ago we did something on the air. I was experimenting with a treadmill desk.
And that's
what I use at home. I have a treadmill desk, which is like a stand-up desk, but you can walk usually at 1 mile per hour. And that is slow enough to allow you to type and to work and to do what you would normally do. But you're getting your body is constantly moving.
Yeah.
And I mean, you can only deal with that for maybe 4 hours.
I feel like a hamster.
You're a little bit like a mouse wheel. Yes, absolutely. But I firmly believe in it.
Let me ask you a little bit about Scotland. I know you haven't got much time. Do you ever have time to go back to Scotland? And if you do, what do you make of it?
Well, we did a roots trip with Peter and Sophie, our son and daughter, and we went to Glasgow to Curzon Street. I took them into the Botanic Gardens, because once you've been in there, you never forget that atmosphere of steam and tropical plants. And then we drove right up through the Trossachs and went up to Glamis, because Peter, at one point when he was growing up, was a member of the children's chorus in the Metropolitan. They both were, actually. But Peter was in that Scottish play. And so when we got up to Glamis, we played the broadcast of that Scottish play, and with the announcer reading off all the names, and Peter McCallum, Fleance, and we were gazing up at Glamis Castle. And so on that trip, we went many, many places all through Scotland. But, you know, when the main characters in your life hand in their portfolios, there's not a great deal of reason. I mean, I've got relations I'd love to see, and we do go back. But I'm really the only one left, although Deanne and Eric would be. Anyway, let's leave the cousins out.
We'll leave them be. Also, as I said, there's so much interest in your very early career. And somebody wants to know what your first part was. Yes, this is Les, who says, what was your first part? Where did you see it taking you when you started? Were you convinced that you were going to have a long and illustrious career?
Oh, yes. There's a very specific King John, Shakespeare. You imagine there was a little place, it's still there, in the Henrietta Barnett School in the Hampstead Garden suburb. There's a little stage, and a little, it's a theatre. Church Hall, I believe they call them. And I played the prince who was about to have his eyes put out by a wicked jailer with a red-hot poker. And I think about at the age of about 8 or 9, I played that part. And it's just one scene. You know, there was a singer and a pianist and a comedian and all that. But at the end of the scene, I got a standing ovation. And I remember thinking, this is where I belong. This is me. No more homework. It's not necessary anymore. I don't have to practice the oboe. I don't have to do anything. I just have to learn these lines. What is it? Boyish charm, to get back to where we began this. And I think that moment was the moment that I made up my mind, I'm going to be in the theater. And I ended up being an electrician, being a plumber, being all the things you have to do to be a stage manager. And eventually, I ended up as a pathologist in Santa Clarita, California.
Wonderful thought. When you were doing Uncle, we haven't talked about Uncle at all. I look back at one of these fan sites for the first series, and they put in these marvelous summaries of the each show and rate them and talk about this fellow Dean Hargrove. Just to give you one example here, this is an episode 25 called The Never Never Affair. The innocent this time is Mandy Stevenson, played by Barbara Feldon, an uncle translator who yearns for excitement. Napoleon Solo sends her on a fictitious mission. In reality, she's getting Waverly more pipe tobacco. By mistake, she's given a microdot with key information about thrush. French thrush leader Victor Gervais, César Romero, is in hot pursuit. Many highlights include an uncle thrush shootout in a movie theater and Napoleon Solo tied up in a chair, improbably shooting and wounding Gervais. Another professional job by director Joseph Sargent, says the writer. Would you remember anything about the man from Uncle these days?
Well, I remember Joe Sargent. He did a lot of Uncles. He was a wonderful director and a good friend. You know, a friend in the sense that, you know, you're working with someone like that. What is my memory of that? I don't remember that. I remember I've seen pictures of César Romero. I remember George Sanders. I remember Elsa Lanchester. And I remember Joan Crawford. And others, but gosh, it's 50 plus years ago.
It must shade off into so much beautiful nonsense, really.
Well, it's wonderful to watch them because they're on called the ME network here, and I watched one the other night with William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy, and they looked like teenagers.
And you, of course, were this idol of all
boys' charm.
Girls.
We have to keep the boys' charm.
Boys' charm, yes. Yeah. How did that go? Can you tell us that story about you and Macy's, the day that you went to Macy's?
That was very simple. They came to me at MGM and said, you have to sing a song because that's what you do. And I said, no, I don't, because I've really never been trained as a singer. And so I wrote an arrangement of woodwind with French horns backing them. That went to H.B. Barnum, who was working with the Supremes. And we ended up at Capitol with David Axelrod and did five albums, which sold over 250,000 records. And I think, as I remember, I got a bill because it cost so much to make the records. But that was the record business back in the 60s. And there was a point where to sell these records, I would make a public appearance in Macy's in New York. And when I got there, they took me up to the executive offices on the top, and the police said, you're not going down there. We couldn't guarantee your safety. So they brought a police car up in the elevator, big freight elevator. I got in with a very hot, sweating, one of New York's finest. And we went down into the ground floor, shot out into Herald Square, and he stalled the car. They'd closed off the roads to get me out. And at that point, I sort of leaned back very nonchalantly, James Bond, and said, you know, you could start this car if you turn the siren and the lights off. And he did, and we took off. But it was, to me, the whole thing was terrifying and amusing at the same time.
It sounds surreal. How do you look back on those days? I mean, does it almost feel like it was a different person to some extent?
No. I did it all. I have this dream once that when I get to heaven or wherever else I go, every single character that I've ever played is sitting there waiting for me in order to critique my performance. The only one who's not there is Ducky. So, you know, they're all friendly faces, I think. And it's been a career full of hard work and wonderful people and great opportunities. And, you know, I think my mother gave me a good sense of responsibility. Take care of yourself and don't expect anything that you don't produce and create. And obviously my English teachers at UCS in Hampstead taught me something about the English language. Otherwise I wouldn't be here.
We're so grateful that you are and that you have been. It's been a wonderful hour with you, and I can't believe it's over. But we can't thank you enough, David McCallum, for being our guest.
No, it's my pleasure, I assure you. Thank you for putting up with me.
It's been a huge pleasure, David. Thank you.